The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I woke up one morning and I asked myself, what did I need to get done? And the answer was nothing. You know, I'm 73 years old. I don't have to do nothing, man. I don't have to worry about making a living anymore. And so I can do what I want to do with my life. Is that cool or what? You know? And well, it's a problematical in a certain way, because what I wanted to do with my life is everything. I've changed the way I cook over the last few years. I found some wonderful recipes, which I love. I cook every single day. I'm on a diet, which is not working. I wonder why. But when I've written 100 books now. I've published 100 books. I've written about 115. The other 15 books, see me later, go talk. But there's so many things I like to do. A couple of years ago, I began watching operas. And some I didn't like, some I liked very, very much. But I felt that there was a distance between my life, lives of the most of the young people I work for, and the lives in the operas. So I'm saying to myself, is there anything I can do about this? I can do anything I want to, right? You know. I said, I thought about, could I take this opera and change it to a different place? Now, there's a couple of reasons I need to do this. Not that I want to do this, but I need to do it, because I need to bridge that distance between what people consider high culture and the people that I know. Now, when I was a kid, I grew up in Harlem. The closest I came to high culture was my neighborhood church. Neighborhood church on the corner, which I published a picture of it on a book with my brother. We were standing there. But occasionally, in those days, they would have concert pianists come to the church. Here in Philadelphia, you have maybe Marian Anderson come to recitals. That's how she began. She began going to churches, and that was her support group. And so what happened? I'm falling apart here, technically. That's okay. Never mind. So what happened, in my church, Langston Hughes would come occasionally, which was an aggravation to me, because when Langston Hughes came, we played ball against the church wall all the time as kids. Some old guy was going to come there and read his books, and we had to stop playing handball against the wall. That was very, very annoying. One time, Josephine Baker came. Was that a disappointment? Because not only was some old woman going to sing, she didn't even sing in English. No, she didn't sing in English. She didn't sing in any accent that I knew. I knew West Indian accents. I knew some Spanish accents. She's singing in French. What was that about? Well, Another thing that happened to me as a kid was that I loved reading. I loved reading, and I loved school. I loved school, not because of what we were learning, but because all kids were in school, kids my age. I could go there and have all these kids who I could instruct on a daily basis, you know, and if need be, I could keep them in order. You know, I fought everybody in school. I fought teachers. I fought other students. I fought boys. I fought girls. I fought teachers. But I had perfect attendance. And that was the important thing. But something else was going on in my life, something that I didn't realize at the time. Books transmit values. So I, somewhere deep inside, I began to understand that what I was learning in school were values. And because I was being held responsible for these values, I knew that these were the important people in the world. But as I read the books, I didn't see my family in those books. I didn't see my family in the books. I didn't see anyone that looked like me in the books. In effect, I had no value. And so somewhere along the line, I decided, well, see, why didn't I have value? Well, because I was black. And so somewhere along the line, I decided, black's a drag, I won't be black anymore. And I decided that I would not be black. And people say, well, okay, Walter, that's cute, but have you looked in the mirror recently? But that actually was going on in Harlem when I was a kid. Many black people decided not to be black. What we decided to be was intellectuals. And so you had a whole movement of young black men and women moving to Europe. James Baldwin, Richard Wright, all the jazz musicians were moving to Europe. Many graphic artists moved to Europe because we were being devalued here and we were being valued in places like Paris. Years later, I met James Baldwin, and I told him this story. And he said, yes, he felt the same way. He felt ugly. Well, he wasn't the best-looking guy in the world to begin with. I mean, if you've seen Jimmy, he told me to call him Jimmy. I couldn't call him Jimmy to his face. Could not. Yes, Mr. Baldwin, I will call you Jimmy, Mr. Baldwin. but what was going on, I understood that values were being transmitted and they did not include me. So all of my life, I wanted, when my kids were coming up, to include my kids in the books that I did. And I worked at this. But I also loved it. Because I loved growing up in Harlem. Harlem, well, why shouldn't I love it? That's where I was raised in a foster home, right? My foster parents were in Harlem. My church was in Harlem. My friends were in Harlem. This was my community. This was my village. This was my village. These were my people. Earlier, Kadir Nelson spoke about Joe Louis. I remember walking into the Apollo and bumping into Joe Louis. Joe Louis was a big dude. He was very big. Sugar Ray Robinson would come around. Okay, so I'm listening to Carmen, and I liked that opera. And I said, you know, can I move this to Harlem? can I move this to Harlem? I said, yeah, I think I can. I think I can. Then I walked into my local bodega, and I saw all these young Latino girls, and they're rattling back and forth, half in English, half in Spanish, half God knows what. And they're back and forth, back and forth. I said, these could be the exact same young ladies that in the Arthur Carmen worked in the cigarette factory. We don't want a book about a cigarette factory today. Now, so I'm thinking these could be the very girls. Can I do this? But I don't know. There was no Carmen. I didn't see a Carmen. I saw maybe a Fresquita, this one and that one. No Carmen. I needed a diva. So I'm on the line one day buying black beans and plantains, and the door opens and this girl comes in and she's angry. Somebody has done her wrong, and I'm saying, "Oh Lord, this is my Carmen." This is my car. She's angry. She's threatening this guy in English and in Spanish. I think I'd rather be threatened in English, because at least I know what's going to be done to me. So I'm looking at this thing and I'm saying, well, let me look at this. Let me reread the. I looked at about 5 versions of Carmen. There are at least 35, 40 versions of this opera. And then I went back to the original novel from which it was taken. And the novel, it's a novella, really, very, very short. But he describes Carmen as having copper skin. I said, oh, really? No. And coarse hair. I said, oh. And he says to her, in the novella, are you a Moor? Now, I had traveled years ago to Granada in Spain. I was at that time researching the path of the Moors from Granada down through Tangiers. We hired a little car. Christopher, my son, was he 7 or 8, I think, around 7 or 8. We hired a car. I don't drive. I don't drive. I daydream. I have a driver's license, but I don't drive. So my wife's driving, and we drove. We spent some time in Granada. And we followed the path of the Moors. And as we got into southern Spain, the people got darker and darker. I said, whoa, And I began thinking about this. And so I decided to move Carmen into Harlem. I'm covering a number of things. I am trying to reach out so that young people in Philly and in New York, in Brixton and London, that these people can find themselves in books. And these are people who perhaps look like me, who sound like me, who have the same problems that I have. And I'm not trying, a kid asked me the other day, what great lesson are you trying to teach? I'm not trying to teach a great lesson. What I want to do is to give value to all young people, to all young people. And so I began writing Carmen, and I put it in East Harlem, and I had the girls, I didn't want them working in a bodega because of that. So I had them working in a wig factory. So they're working in a big factory. I have, in the original Carmen, Mérimée, the French author, and for which, for, These girls would all have been exotic because this was a French author. The two guys who wrote the libretto were also French. Moors and anybody in Spain, southern Spain, would have been exotic. So I've got these people in Spanish Harlem, and what to do with the music? I love the music for Carmen. It's so, you know, everybody knows the music from Carmen. You know, you hear it, you know, it's just wonderful stuff. But I'm listening to the music, and I'm thinking, what more can I do with it? Can I do anything more with the music? I'm thinking that you can't change the music. The music is there. That's Bizet. You don't mess with Bizet, you know. I mean, maybe you can arrange it differently, though. So I'm changing the libretto, and I'm thinking, what can I do with this music to just make it a little more? This is the thing my editor gave me. This is not going to work. Maybe it's going to work. So I decided if it doesn't work, it's her fault. Now, this is supposed to play. Is it playing? Do you hear anything? Now, what do you do?
Turn it on the top.
The top is on. This is on. This is plugged in. Oops, not plugged in the right place. All right, thank you, dear. Oh, they learn fast. They learn fast. So what I decided to do, because the songs are so well known, was to change the entr'actes in between the acts of Carmen. You have the entr'acte, which is just sort of incidental music, and some of it. And so what I've done here is I had a young composer. Is that familiar? Except he's putting a merengue beat to it. Again, what I'm trying to do is to bring not only the libretto, but the music. This is music that young people can listen to, dance, and recognize. And yet, they can go to the original Bizet composition and hear exactly where this is coming from. Is this great or what? Say yes. This is the scene before the smugglers are going off into the mountains. All right. Now the other one. This is normally done with a flute and a harp, and I put a lyric to this. It's done normally as an instrumental piece, but Carmen realizes that Jose is a nut and that he's a dangerous person. And she sings, "Love comes easy, but it just wasn't for me. Now, I gave my heart, gave my soul." Yeah. Do you recognize this? What I've hoped to do was to forge that connection between the classical, between the world known, and bring it right into an urban situation. This is what I wanted to do here, and this is what, with the help of this young composer, and with the help of my lovely editor, I think I've done. You have questions about this? Okay, give me a question.
I can only ask you this, or I can only phrase this because of my age. How can an old geezer like you find the language of youth? I finished reading Monster, and I've read other books by you. Where do you place yourself physically to hear the language and then put it on paper?
To a large extent, I don't have to do that, because what the kids are doing is creating language. They're creating language. So what I say to myself, what I need to do is to pick up some of their language and create my own. You know, when I was a kid, I used to hear my stepfather talking. And certain expressions, says, where did he get that from? Then my grandfather came and to live with us. And I said, oh, now I see my father took from my grandfather, put his spin on it. And this is how language is created. Language is created. I listen to young people, but I don't try to mimic them. Because if you try to mimic them, you just get into that very stiff mode.
As you were talking, and you said that you were in this book trying to forge a connection between, you know, the high art from the past and contemporary right. pop culture. And I think that's great, because I think high art is great, and I think young people, and I'm not that old, but I already feel like I can refer to people who are younger than me,
right.
That they need this in their life. But coming from, you know, these young people might not have that assumption that they need high art in their life. And what would you say to someone who doesn't see the value? Like, what is this book saying to people? Why do they need this in their life, and why is it important to forge this connection?
It's important. Well, the basic reason that it's important is to give young people value. You know what happens? I recently read, about 2 years ago, Viktor Frankl's fabulous book, Man's Search for Meaning. And what you have to do is to look at every single person's core existence as a search for value. Frankl was in the concentration camp, but later in his life, he talked about offenders, criminals. He said, what you have to do with these people is to look at their core as a search for value. And very often, they don't find values. Now, people say, why are these people out here gangbanging? Why are they gangbanging? Well, they're gangbanging looking for value. And if they cannot find the values in their own lives, if they can't find a value in finding an apartment, in their employment, then they find it in toughness, in being tough. And they're searching for values. Young women, the same thing. They're searching for values. So here is, I spend a lot of time in juvenile detention facilities. Here's a young girl in a juvenile detention facility, the same one that Mike Tyson used to be in as a kid. And I asked these girls, what's the worst part about being in jail? And the young girls said, two of them, there were two 14-year-olds, and they were saying that the worst part about it was not knowing where your children were. The 14-year-olds, so that meant to me that at 12 and 13, these girls were being abused, but they were a participant in that abuse because they are searching for values. So, and someone, some older dude, and all the fathers are older guys, they're not 12 and 13-year-old boys. The older guys are saying, yo, mama, you sure are fine. You're looking good. And for some of these girls, that's the only value that they have. So what I want to do with the books is to give them values. Now, yes, you are, number one, in the pages of a book. You are in the pages of a book. You know, there are people with names that sound like yours in the pages of a book. Someone has thought enough about you and your life to put you in a book. This is what I want to do. Second thing I would like to do, I would like them to think about the characters. I was on a train, and I saw a girl reading one of my books. I said, oh, she's reading my book. You know, it thrills you. It thrills you. And then she looked up from the book. She put her finger in it, closed the book up, and she's thinking. And now, for that brief moment, I have inhabited that girl's mind. I am in that girl's mind. I have given her something to think about. And yes, Lord, it's great. It's good. It's good. And this is what I want. You know, so I think that my books don't have to be written that well. They don't have to be delivering an uplifting message. But I am giving these kids value. And I think this is what they need. If a kid picks up a book, finds themselves in the book, and values themselves, then they can fulfill their own potential.
Hi. Are you basing your writings on true stories that you may hear from other people? And, you know, can you share with me about how are you writing your books?
I base my stories on every single thing in the world. I have 5 books coming out this year. Oh, God, you know. Well, I figured, you know, look at this. I have 5 books coming out this year, and whatever I think about, I can write. You know, Kadir Nelson, he's such a fine artist. He's so fine an artist. But Kadir was saying that someone asked him, did he have to sell his ideas? And he doesn't, because his ideas are based upon his talent. I mean, you see that man's work, and you want to sign him up for something, right? With me, I'm 73 years old, man. I know. I make money as a mama. I don't have to do anything. So I can go to my lovely editor and say, can I do something? And she'll say, okay. But, you know, I mean, it's a wonderful position to be in. But so right now I'm working on a book on the social contract. Rousseau, Locke, Hobbes. And I'm trying to make that accessible to inner city teens. I don't know, maybe next year I'll redo the Bible. Bring it into East Harlem.
I was wondering how we can get that beautiful music that you played. That was incredible. Is there a way for us to get it, our hands on it or our ears on it?
You know, so what happened was that I contacted a very young person. I think he was 7 or 8, maybe 30. However these young people come. I asked him, can you do something with this? Can you make an arrangement? He makes arrangements for jazz bands. And he did it. So it was just remarkable music. If you go to it, you'll see it's clearly Bizet, and it's wonderful. And thanks for having me in Philadelphia again.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.